thousands rally in the Yemeni city of Sada to condemn a U.S. move to blacklist the Ansarullah movement. A Russian vessel involved in the construction of Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline begins working in Danish waters despite a threat of sanctions by the U.S. Opinion polls show public support for Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga is dwindling over his response to the coronavirus pandemic. This is World News with me, Tehru Sanjafi. Welcome. Starting with Yemen, thousands of people have taken to the streets in the city of Sada to slam the U.S. decision to blacklist the Ansarullah movement. Demonstrators urging the U.S. authorities to reverse the decision. Former U.S. President Trump designated the group as a terrorist organization in the final days of his administration. That triggered protests from the United Nations and international aid groups. UN officials say it will further complicate efforts to combat the world's worst humanitarian crisis. A political commentator, Hussein al-Bukhaiti, says that the U.S. blacklisting of the Ansarullah movement will add to the suffering of the Yemeni nation caught in the years-long war.
Of course, this latest designation actually will affect many United Nations and other NGOs who are working on Yemen, because we have this blockade in Yemen, the closure of the airport, and only like every 2 or 3 months few flights come to Sana'a with the food and medicine, and as well Saudi Arabia after 3 or 5 to 6 months of blocking ships to go into Yemen. Sometimes they let some ships every now and then, but this latest designation actually will affect those international NGOs in Yemen work. It will affect the money transferred from outside to those NGOs in Sana'a or in other city. And I believe this was the main goal from this latest designation. Saudi Arabia, after they couldn't break the Yemeni people, they destroyed all port and airport. They want to make Yemeni suffer. They think that Yemenis are stupid, that we're going to blame, and me as Yemeni, we're going to blame the Houthi for this, for what's happening in Yemen. That's why this latest designation, it wants to stop the pressure and the suffering of Yemeni people. But this latest protest, it shows that despite the fact Yemen is under blockade, as under constant attack for the last 6 war, Yemeni are actually going to be united and they will fight back.
Now, Iran is stressing that it will not change its stance as regard a 2015 nuclear deal unless it witnesses the effective implementation of the deal by other signatories. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says that Tehran has not seen any developments regarding the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. He underlined that Iran wants all the sanctions removed. The spokesman says that Iran will reverse the measures it's taken to scale down its commitments only after the other parties fulfill their obligations. The official urged the new U.S. government to act if it wants to correct the mistakes of the previous administration. A Russian pipeline ship involved in the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project has started working, and that a week after sanctions threat by the previous U.S. administrations. And this is what is reported by the company that owns the ship. It says that the Fortuna is now engaged in building a corridor in the waters off Denmark ahead of resuming the Nord Stream construction. Several Russian support vessels are also said to be in the immediate vicinity. The 10 billion euro pipeline that will run beneath the Baltic Sea is to double Russian natural gas shipments to Germany. The pipeline, which is more than 90% complete, has long been a contentious issue for the U.S., especially under former President Trump. Washington has imposed many rounds of sanctions on companies involved in that project, arguing that it would increase Europe's reliance on Russian energy. China has accused the United States of what it calls flexing its muscles by often sending warships and aircraft into the South China Sea. Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian says that the U.S. moves are not conducive to peace and stability in the region. On Saturday, a U.S. carrier group led by USS Theodore Roosevelt entered the South China Sea, and that after Taiwan claimed an incursion by Chinese warplanes into its air defense identification zone. The strategic waters, also claimed by several regional countries, have long been a focus of contention between Beijing and Washington. China is also critical of U.S.'s boosting of ties with self-ruled Taiwan, which it views as part of its territory. Beijing has repeatedly urged Washington to abide by the One China policy and to stop meddling in its internal affairs. U.S. President Joe Biden is planning to reinstate a coronavirus travel restriction on most non-U.S. citizens entering his country from Britain, Brazil, Ireland, and much of Europe. A White House official says Biden will also extend the ban to travelers who've been to South Africa. The decision was made amid warnings that new, more transmissible coronavirus variants are already establishing themselves in the United States. And that just 1 week after former President Trump, in his final days in office, ordered the restrictions to be lifted. The U.S. is the world's hardest hit nation by the coronavirus. More than 25 million cases and 420,000 deaths have been recorded there since the pandemic began. Colin Campbell says if measures by the previous U.S. administration failed to curb the COVID pandemic in the country.
The nation is still in a pattern of healing, and that is because there have been so many coronavirus cases over the past year and hundreds of thousands of deaths. We're still projected to hit 600,000 deaths before the virus is fully contained. And that's why the current president wants to still impose a ban on travel coming from other countries, because we're still a nation that has not had complete control over the virus. Although some states have a plateau in the number of new cases, when you look from coast to coast, there's still a number of cases in a number of states where the virus still hasn't been contained. And to introduce new people and new entrants into within our borders would just further increase the possibility that the virus would spread. And so that's why the president is now reimposing those travel restrictions. It almost seemed to defy logic for the previous president to lift those restrictions as we were still dealing with the pandemic. It was almost like he was in constant denial up until the point where he left office, and he might still be in denial. So the current president is trying to do, from what it seems like, the best he can to keep the virus under control, to keep the number of casualties, the number of deaths, lower than would be anticipated. And of course, that would include decreasing the amount of travelers coming from other countries into the United States, where the possibility of the spread of the virus could increase.
Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga is under pressure for his handling of the coronavirus pandemic. An opinion poll indicates support for Suga's cabinet has dropped to 33% from 39% last month. 80% of the respondents believe that the government was too slow to declare a state of emergency to tackle the pandemic. Opposition lawmakers have criticized Suga for his style of leadership. They demand the Prime Minister provide detailed answers to questions about a pandemic crisis and the Tokyo Olympics set to start in less than 6 months. Japan has registered 365,000 COVID cases and 5,100 deaths. Now, in the Netherlands, police have arrested some 250 people in the midst of violent nationwide rallies against a curfew to curb the spread of COVID-19. The police used dogs and water cannon to disperse the ralliers in Amsterdam. In the southern city of Eindhoven, police fired tear gas to disperse a crowd of several hundreds. Similar incidents were reported in other cities, including in The Hague, Breda, and Arnhem. The curfew, which is the country's first since the Second World War, is set to last until February 10th. The Netherlands was already under its toughest measures since the beginning of the pandemic. New variants of the virus, particularly a more infectious strain that first emerged in Britain, have led to deep concerns in Europe. It's time now for the news review. Do stay with us. Former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown is warning that the UK must reform how it is governed or risk becoming, quote, a failed state. Brown says the COVID-19 crisis, as well as nationalism and uncertainty about the post-Brexit Britain, threatens the unity of the kingdom. He said that unity depends on a fair and workable delineation of powers after Brexit. The warning comes as the Brexit and the COVID-19 crises have weakened the bonds between England, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland. The United Kingdom has faced many political hurdles and experienced an economic downturn since the beginning of the pandemic and a separation from the EU's single market. Let's get some information and some insight on this. So joining me will be Robert Carter, our correspondent in London, and also Rodney Shakespeare, professor of economics, joining us also from London. Good to have both of you in the show, gentlemen. Let me ask Robert Carter about the problems and issues that the UK has been facing recently, especially after this Brexit thing happened.
Sure. Well, obviously, as you know, there is a global pandemic going on. But the UK is a little bit different from, say, its European neighbours because it's also dealing with other crises such as the Brexit transition period. It's, you know, trying to figure out what its economy is doing in that sense. But also the economic impact from the pandemic has had an additional shockwave, if you like, to the economy. And it is being felt now. Just this morning, it was announced that one of the largest retailer chains known as Debenhams has been sold, and its stores across the country are not going to reopen after the lockdown has been lifted. Now that means at least 10,000 Debenhams staff members are quite likely not going to be in work going forward and have to look for new jobs. So the retail industry is having a massive impact. It's also being forecast in British news this morning that the economies in the north of England, which were due an investment injection to try and revive their failing local economies, may have to take at least four times more additional investment to get them up and running. And the south of the country may have to downgrade the size of its local economies in order to kind of balance out the UK. Gordon Brown, the former Prime Minister, also mentioned the fact that nationalism movements are on the rise. And in particular, he's referring to Scotland, which has a massive momentum in the pro-independence movement at the moment and is pushing for a new independence referendum. But also in Wales as well and the north of Ireland, there seems to be a popular trend towards reunifying Ireland and breaking up the UK, essentially. So there is new crises potentially on the horizon with the breakup of the UK, but also right now the economy is taking a massive hit too.
Right. Now, Professor Shakespeare, what's your assessment of the current circumstances in the UK? And do you also agree with Gordon Brown, who says that reform is needed in the governance?
A tiny glimmer of light is beginning to enter the benighted brain of Gordon Brown. He thinks, oh, well, it must be something to do with Scottish independence, to do with Brexit. Brexit is certainly affecting the situation, as Robert Carter has pointed out. But the key point is that for anyone who looks at any of these things and sees the connection between Trumpism, between the Brexit movement, between the yellow vests, between what's going on in Italy, between what's going on in country after country, is that some very fundamental things are going on, and that's what's happening now is that the virus has impacted on top of that. 2019 was the sign when the banks stopped lending to each other, and that's always one year before a great collapse comes. And you see, what's really happening is the rich poor division is increasing, and they have no answer to the technological shift, which is smashing out the traditional jobs, which is hollowing out the middle classes. In America, real incomes have been going backwards for 25 years, and this is at a time when the capacity to create wealth, the physical, technological, machine capacity to create wealth has massively increased. So you see, what's going on is not going to be corrected by the end of the pandemic. And of course, what's happened, going to happen is the end of the pandemic and the end of the schemes. And suddenly, we will realize that the whole thing is dislocated. All the money's gone in the wrong places. It's not gone into the real economy and the spreading of the real economy to every person. It's not gone to addressing the technological shift. And So you're looking at what was going to be one massive great disaster and a great big global economic collapse. But Gordon Brown thinks, oh, just put the clock back and all will be right. It won't be. It all will be wrong, and he has no solution to it, nor does the British government.
Okay, let me ask Robert Carter about this nationalism thing that, Robert, you mentioned, and the reasons for this, because this is the time we see that divergence is happening. This people are kind of moving toward disintegration from Great Britain.
Yes, well, I think that distrust in Westminster is at an all-time high, even people within England itself. And you have to remember that the UK is a very English-centric country. Scotland, Wales, and the north of Ireland feel very left out in terms of investment, in terms of political say. And so ultimately, those countries within the UK are starting to realize now that, do you know what, we're probably going to be better off alone. They don't trust leaders like Boris Johnson. They didn't vote for Brexit. They don't believe that Westminster has handled the COVID crisis acceptably at all. And in fact, if comparisons are made between Scotland's regional governments and Westminster itself, Scotland tends to act a lot quicker, and so does Wales, for example, in initiating lockdowns, in stopping people going back to school or going back to work, than Westminster has. So ultimately, people across the country are just deeply dissatisfied with Westminster. They don't particularly identify as being British anymore. They're starting to identify as Scottish, Welsh, or their local native denomination. And that is a reality that Westminster just doesn't seem to have to understand. They think that by ignoring the Scottish independence movement or by, you know, issuing threats or refusing to give them a referendum until 2050, as Boris Johnson has put it, that it will just go away. But the problem is boiling under the surface, and it's only a matter of time before it spills over.
Now, Professor Shakespeare, how do you look at things in the future unfolding? Do you see, let's say, this United Kingdom on the horizon?
Well, the key point is that the unease, which Robert has identified, is the symptom and not the cause.
Right.
And therefore, self-government movements and that sort of thing will continue, but they won't actually solve the underlying problem.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments and contribution. Robert Carter joined us from London. Also, we had Professor Rodney Shakespeare, Professor of Economics out of London, with their comments and contribution, and that's the end of this news review. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hi everyone, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our episodes aim to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will dive deep in the history of terror and torment against the Hazara Shia Muslim community in Pakistan, and discuss how Islamabad's reaction to Daesh attacks may influence the future of Takfiri terrorism throughout Asia.
Takfiri terrorists have recently leveled up their scale and frequency of attacks in the western edge of the subcontinent. Active mainly in Afghanistan and Pakistan, these Daesh followers, or the so-called Khorasan ISIS, have a long history of targeting Shia Muslims in the region, particularly the Hazaras. The latest bout of terror attacks against Hazara Shias has put Pakistan in the spotlight again over its lack of capabilities or resolve to protect its minority communities against the extremists.
This year started with yet another horrid tragedy for Pakistan's Hazara Shias, a Muslim minority in a country made for Muslims. The deadly attack occurred in the early days of January when terrorists slaughtered a group of Hazara people who were working as miners in Mach, an area 17 kilometers east of Quetta, the capital of Pakistan's southwestern Balochistan province. The gunmen abducted the coal miners and took them to nearby mountains. Then they blindfolded them, tied their hands behind their backs, and opened fire at them from close range. Most of the victims' throats were also cut. Daesh Takfiris, or ISIL, later claimed responsibility for the attack through its communication channels. Haji Jawad, a local Hazara leader, described the act of terror as an attempt to sabotage peace in the province and to provoke sectarian strife, urging the government to bring the perpetrators to justice immediately. As news of the killing spread through the community, Hazaras took to the streets in protest, blocking a highway near Quetta. The bodies were placed on the road as protesters called for the government and security forces to follow through on promises to ensure their safety.
The horrendous and absolutely brutal terrorist attack was condemned by an overwhelming number of people and groups, both from inside and outside of Pakistan. But the Hazara people, who felt fed up with the inaction vis-a-vis such atrocities, wanted something more tangible than mere denunciations. They held several days of protests and did not bury the victims until the Pakistani Prime Minister accepted to go to Quetta and promised better protection for them.
Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan was quick to tweet about the assault, condemning the killing of the coal miners as another cowardly, inhuman act of terrorism. But when Hazaras started rallies and asked for a visit by the Prime Minister to hear their demands for justice and security, he called their request blackmail. This set off further furor throughout the country. Finally, after about a week of demonstrations in major cities across Pakistan, Khan promised to visit the grieving community and assure their protection. Retrospectively, it seems paradoxical that the premier was so unwilling for the visit. Before coming to power in 2018, Khan was known as a vocal decrier of Pakistan's leaders for not doing more to stop attacks on the Hazara community and for not rushing to Quetta to offer condolences after similar assaults. Authorities vowed the arrest of the attackers, payment of compensation to the bereaved families, and better security for the Hazara. They also announced plans to set up a high-level commission headed by Balochistan's Home Minister to investigate attacks against the Hazara community in the past 22 years.
The name Hazara is said to be derived from a phrase which used to mean happy and sublime heart. After decades and even centuries of agonizing alienation, these Persian-speaking Shia Muslims still have sublime hearts, but they are not happy. They mostly live in two fortified enclaves in Quetta, home to more than 600,000 Hazaras, whose Central Asian features make them an easy target for Takfiri attackers who consider them heretics.
Having a history of persecution by fanatics, Hazaras are of the view that they are living as prisoners in Quetta. These hardworking and talented people, who have excelled in society when given any chance, are living in a precarious situation. They hardly can exercise their fundamental rights as human beings. They can't move freely and have to restrict their daily activities to specific areas because almost nowhere is safe for them. The prevailing situation of fear due to back-to-back bombings, shootings, and suicide attacks has displaced many of these frustrated people across the country and forced many others abroad. In the past several decades, thousands of Hazaras have been killed by Takfiri ideologues in Afghanistan and Pakistan, the likes of Lashkar-e-Jangvi or Daesh Khorasan. Following each carnage, authorities have repeated their hollow promises. Hazaras have heard it all. They want concrete plans for reform and rehabilitation.
The geopolitical upheaval that followed the U.S. invasion to the region proved to be the death knell for many people. The U.S. so-called war on terror made extremists and terrorists in Afghanistan, and Pakistan joined hands with the U.S. but simultaneously supported the Taliban also. Hazaras were among the most vulnerable people in the face of the fiery attacks. Countrywide, Saudi-sponsored madrasas to teach Wahhabism on the backdrop of Islamabad's decade-old policy of appeasement towards anti-Shia militancy seemed as other factors of the Takfiri crimes.
The Daesh attack on miners wasn't just about aggravating the grief and fear of Hazaras. Takfiri see such bloodshed as useful propaganda weapons to cultivate wealthy and powerful benefactors. Daesh presence in Pakistan started with a series of graffiti by supporters of the group, but spread fast as the group forged alliances with like-minded extremists and enjoyed the support of a nationwide network of Saudi-backed madrasas. Thanks to madrasas, the Daesh in Pakistan is even more successful in recruitments than Afghanistan. The fact that Washington is in open and direct talks with Taliban after decades of war is a proof for Daesh that if it manages to establish a stronghold in the region, the United States will ultimately have to sit on the negotiation table with them. This may intensify the rivalry between Daesh and Taliban both in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Pakistan plays a critical role in the Taliban-US negotiations. And since the power and reach of Takfiris in Pakistan are directly dependent on the status of the group in Afghanistan, Islamabad's response to extremist attacks will be crucial for the future of Takfiri terrorism across the subcontinent and South Asia.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, we are now joined by Dr. Liaquat Ali Khan, who is an emeritus professor at Washburn University School of Law. Mr. Khan, welcome to our show. So, why is Daesh Takfiri group increasing its activities in Pakistan?
Well, I think Daesh, first we need to know what Daesh is. I think it's predominantly an Arab group that is trying to force Islam and a certain version of Islam on the Muslim countries. I mean, of course, they are fighting the West, but I think that is probably not their main goal. I think their main goal is to go to different Muslim countries, whether it is Syria or Afghanistan or Pakistan or Iraq, and first of all, take hold of the territory so that they can operate freely from there. And second, they have very distinct ideas regarding what they need to do. I think they are trying to reimpose the rule of the Arabs over the Arabs and over the Arabs and non-Arab populations, because they think that Islam has drifted away from its motherland and from its original people, and therefore they are resurrecting the Islam that they think should be the Islam of everyone. And they totally feel that whether it's Syria or Iraq or Iran or any other Muslim country, they have left the true message of Islam, and therefore they need to reimpose, even by force, on the populations living in Arab and non-Arab countries. So I think they feel that Pakistan, because of its size, and also because it has nuclear weapons, it needs to come under the influence of ISIS. And I think they have found a way to, to pursue that mission. So they are in Afghanistan, which is totally in chaos, and I think they're going to operate from Afghanistan until they have a strong foothold there, which they already do, and then attack the people they don't like and harass the governments so that they become frustrated and confused, and then they enter the territory. So in other words, I think ISIS is looking for a global domination of their versions of Islam. I think they mistakenly believe that they can resurrect the 7th century where the first Muslims expanded their rule over almost half the world at that time. So I think they have those dreams, and they feel that Pakistan is an essential milestone or an essential geography in order to control the Muslim world.
All right, so you're saying that they want to make territorial gains, reimpose their own version of Islam, and Pakistan is particularly important because of nuclear weapons and geostrategic importance. So what are the roles of Saudi Arabia's madrasas in recruiting and training terrorist activities and takfiris in Pakistan?
I can say in very broad terms that the philosophy of ISIS is not very different from the teachings of Abdul Wahhab, who is followed in Saudi Arabia. And I think, again, the mission is to go back to the first 50 years of Islam, which was, predominantly Arab. I think there was Salman Farsi over there, but there were very few non-Arabs who were the pioneers of Islam. And for some reason, I think Saudi Arabia and ISIS, they feel that they have to go back to the first 50 years and resurrect that sensibility, that mission of Islam, and go to different countries with Arabs as the center of the movement. And I'm not sure if that can be done now. I think Islam has, moved away, actually, for miles, and intellectually, and otherwise, from the original 50 years. Even though the Quran and the Prophet, I mean, they're still authentic, and they are still part of Islam and this central part of Islam. But I'm not sure if the first 50 years can be resurrected in its entirety.
All right, Mr. Khan, let's just go and take a quick look at how global media has covered this issue, and then we can continue.
Pakistan is home to 220 million people, almost all of whom are Muslim, It is also home to one of the largest Shia populations in the world, as an estimated 20% of Muslims there are Shia. At Wadia Hussein Graveyard, red flags are planted by the graves of observant Shia Muslims who have died in targeted killings, guns or bomb attacks. Since 2001, more than 2,600 Shia Muslims have been killed in violent attacks in the South Asian country, according to the South Asia Terrorism Portal Research Organization. This year has seen an uptick in targeted killings against Shias. The persecution of the Hazara community dates all the way back to the 16th century and the reign of the Mughal Emperor Babur in the region. And the cause behind this targeting of the community, which by the late 19th century had become full-blown ethnic cleansing, is underscored by Emperor Babur in his memoirs Baburnama. The Mughals targeted Hazaras for their Twelver Shia religious identity and Mongol heritage. Half a millennium later, it is the same ethno-religious combination that is being used to fan genocide of the Hazaras. For 22 years, our demands are the same, that our killers are arrested, that their facilitators are arrested, and those who lead them be arrested. It is not so difficult to understand this. If the rulers do not understand this, then I do not know what their compulsions are, that they cannot act against those who lead these terrorists, nor can they act against the attackers themselves, said Said Muhammad Raza, a local leader of the Shia Muslim Majlis Wahdat-e-Muslimin, MWM political party.
All right, Mr. Khan, welcome back to our show. So please tell us how the situation for Hazara Shia Muslims is in Pakistan. Why does no one protect them?
Well, I think if you look at Hazaras, it is a population which has, sort of Mongolian ethnicity. I think they are called the children of Genghis Khan. But that was, seven centuries ago. So it seems like over the seven centuries, the Hazaras, a distinct ethnic group, and they're scattered in the region. I think there are 500,000 in Iran. There are probably more than 500,000 in Pakistan, and there are quite a few in central Afghanistan. And I was, researching that there are some also in Australia, 200,000 of them, some in Europe, very few in America. So it seems like the Hazaras, they are a population that is ethnically different from wherever they are. I think they're different from Pashtuns, they're different from Iranians, and they are different from the Punjabis and the Sindhis and the Balochis in Pakistan. Even though in Pakistan they are in Balochistan, but nevertheless their ethnic separation is still there, just like it is there in Afghanistan and even in Iran and obviously in Australia. So that is first reason that a lot of Pakistanis and even Pashtuns feel that the Hazaras are not from the region, that they're aliens, that they're foreigners. And that is first reason that, nobody owns them. And that's very unfortunate that after having lived for 700 years, in these countries, they still feel that they are foreigners, and the people feel that they are foreigners too. So it's a disconnect between their presence and their belonging to Pakistan and Afghanistan. So I think just like foreigners are mistreated everywhere, I think Hazaras are mistreated in Afghanistan as well as in Pakistan.
All right, thank you so much, Mr. Khan, for being with us on our show. It was really nice having you here. We have with us Mr. Zafar Mehdi, and let's talk to him and see what's been going on social media.
Salam, John Hussein. This is Said Zafar Mehdi, and today we will discuss social media buzz past few weeks over the carnage in Pakistan where 10 Hazara Shias were brutally killed by Daesh Takfiri terrorist group. This is not the first time and perhaps won't be the last. So naturally there is anger, there is outrage, and there is frustration. Let's take a look at some of the reactions on social media over this incident. Author and lecturer Mohammed Shujai points to safety and security concerns of this vulnerable ethnic minority. He terms the lack of action in preventing violence against Hazara Shias a betrayal. Twitter user Mohammed Ehsanullah says it's not important to be a Shia to understand the pain and plight of this community. He urges the Pakistani government to take action. In another tweet, user Faika says the anger within the community is justified because state has failed to provide them protection. She refers to an incident 8 years ago when over 100 Hazara Shias were killed in the same place, which shows nothing has changed for them all these years. Political commentator Michael Kugelman, responding to Pakistani journalist Moeed Pirzada, says this incident points to the emergence of Daesh in Pakistan. He says the militant group first made inroads in the country back in 2015 in the form of Daesh Khorasan. Professor Adnan Rasool says it's time to pause and think why the Hazara community has to deal with this kind of relentless persecution. And he has an important question: why the Pakistani government has been unable to address this issue. Like many social media users, lawyer Benazir Jatoi criticizes the government of Imran Khan for poor handling of this issue and his reluctance in reaching out to the families of victims. She terms it the lowest point for the government. User Zahra says the plight of Hazara Shias has no takers, not even the so-called champions of human rights. She says Daesh is basically the creation of US, and she cites an assassination of top anti-Daesh commander General Qasem Soleimani as an example of US complicity in Daesh crimes. Thanks for being with us. It's back to you, Jonathan, in the studio.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was our episode about the history of terror against the Hazara Shia Muslim community in Pakistan. We'll meet next week.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. By Hujjatul Islam, Zaid As-Salam.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, and welcome to IRIB English Radio and another episode of For Humanity, where we are discussing the treaties of rights of Imam Ali al-Sajjad Zain al-Abidin. We're talking about the rights of the adversary. And when it comes to the rights of the adversary, there are many things that we need to keep in mind. If someone has a claim against you, or you have a claim against someone, there are certain things that you need to keep in mind. And in this introduction that we're trying to present here, there is a fundamental importance in knowing what Islam says about the practice of how to deal with a conflict and how to resolve a conflict, especially if you are in the position of arbitrating between two individuals. You need to make sure that you not only have the level of knowledge. There's a hadith that says you need to flee away from verdict, giving a verdict the way you flee away from a lion. Now here the word fatwa is used. Fatwa in the broader sense means verdict as far as religious law is concerned. But this certain tradition has also been used within the context of arbitrating and of being a judge. A judge not only needs to have a level of expertise when it comes to understanding the laws and everything surrounding it, but also they need to have high integrity. They need to be righteous. They need to be pious. They need to have a perfect reputation in the community. So much so that there is no hesitation when someone is to say that this judge issued this particular verdict. They would not be claimed to, for example, be corrupt or have accepted a bribe or anything along those lines. If the judge has full understanding and full coverage of the areas that is happening and knowing what it is that's going on, then of course they're going to be fair in their judgment and they will be upholding justice, which is what they should be doing. With today's society, we understand that, you know, it's very easy to be misled by wrong information, by propaganda, by victimizing oneself, and all of these other things that could happen in a dispute. And of course, the position of the judge needs to be in such a way where they stay away from being influenced by any of these particular things. And that's why evidence is very, very important, even in the lines of what Islam has said and what Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam have spoken about as far as evidence is concerned. And it is a legal code, and it is something spoken clearly by the Holy Prophet and by the Imams, especially that if you do not have anything to be held against someone as proof or as evidence, then you have absolutely no right to show any kind of hostility or judgment against someone. And that's why there are certain conditions for judging and upholding of justice, because justice is one of the properties that the Holy Quran very, very clearly holds in a high value. We're going to go for a short break and we will be back very, very soon. Please stay tuned.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. And we were speaking about justice and how justice fits in our particular understanding based on the Holy Quran and also the Sunnah of Islam as well. when you come to being a just person, you need to make sure that this level of adala, or you having adl, is not only within the courtroom but also outside of the courtroom. One of the conditions of being an imam for jama'ah prayers is that you be adil, that you be just. Just in the sense that you have a high level of integrity and righteousness. You are able to see how important being just is, not only in imam of jama'ah, not only as a witness in the court, not only as a witness for divorce, not only in the level of being a mujtahid, you need to be adil as well, even as far as medical staff is concerned, as far as a doctor is concerned, as far as any other kind of professions are concerned, because people are entrusting themselves with you. People have confidence in you being someone who's doing something correct and fair way. And wisdom, of course, is also very, very important. In many cases, a person needs to have that level of knowledge and understanding for them to be able to do something in the correct, committed way. Which is exactly why when you find the level of positivity in certain areas, it's going to mean that it is done so for a greater purpose. That there is a reason as to why there's such an emphasis in a judge being just, being fair, being righteous, being pious. For example, if a certain medicine is ascribed to someone, to a patient, and that patient, you know, has a certain sickness that is very, very intimate, very private, very confidential. They know that this doctor is not going to be reckless and share any kind of information to anybody else. They're going to stay committed and they are going to be as confidential as possible. They're also going to be very, very fair in what it is that they do. And therefore, they're not going to be treating anything in the wrong way. And this is exactly why, apart from the fact that there is the condition of justice in the establishing of arbitration, there is also the need for religious practice as far as being righteous and noble is concerned. If you have a conflict, if you are an adversary, then you need to make sure that someone who is the person who is dealing with it is going to deal with it in the necessary, correct, and positive way. It's necessary to note here that regardless of who the individual may be, justice must always prevail. The laws must always prevail, whether it be in your advantage or whether it be in your disadvantage. Please visit our website on www.parstoday.com, or you're able to communicate with us through our email of englishradio@irib.ir. Until our next program, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasuli wa ali nabiyil azim. Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasuli wa ali nabiyil azim.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio.